It is a cold evening in early December 1901. Joseph Pulitzer has left his townhouse on East 73rd Street this evening for his annual outing to a Christmas tree lighting in Central Park. The tree is near a large pond used as a skating rink across 59th Street from the opulent new Plaza Hotel. Joseph Pulitzer is now older, tired, and infirm. To add to his physical ailments, Pulitzer's mood is melancholy. He still feels pangs of guilt over the world's role in starting the Spanish-American War 3 years earlier. He's tired of profiting from countless other exaggerated and salacious stories. He doesn't want yellow journalism to be his legacy. Standing near the tree, with the crowd bathed in candlelight, Pulitzer thinks he spots someone in the crowd. He tells his wife, Catherine, and his medical aide that he wants to go get a closer look. And sure enough, standing there on the other side of the tree is William Randolph Hearst. Pulitzer makes his way over.
Mr. Hearst.
Mr. Pulitzer.
I never thought I'd see another hard-bitten journalist in this kind of setting.
Well, I do occasionally fall off the beam. You may have heard. I am exploring a run for Congress.
Elected office, huh? I was a Missouri legislator once. Can't exactly recommend it. Nowhere near as fun as newspapers.
The mere mention of Hearst's name used to make Pulitzer furious. Now, seeing his enemy makes him more nostalgic than anything else.
You think it was all worth it? All that frenzy for scoops?
Hearst shrugs.
It's been a hell of an adventure, hadn't it?
Have you thought about the truce I proposed? The world can handle the more upscale news, and we'll leave you and the Journal with all the hurdy-gurdy.
I'm still thinking about it. Remember, I'm the one who hired Mark Twain to write for the San Francisco Examiner. You know, I'm not just gonna cede you the high ground.
Pulitzer sighs. Hearst and Pulitzer smile, tip their hats to each other, and Pulitzer heads back to his wife. This is the first time the two longtime rivals have ever met. It will also be their last.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. We have come to the final episode of Hearst versus Pulitzer. You're listening to Episode 6, Days of Atonement. As the days of yellow journalism fade behind them, both men try to rewrite their legacy. For a few years, Pulitzer and Hearst try to divvy up the market into the news's high ground and low ground.
but they're never quite able to come to any formal agreement. Even without a handshake, though, the journal and the world begin to go in different directions. And so do the paper's legendary bosses. For Hearst, politics is the new focus. His father had been a U.S. senator back in the 1880s when young Will was embarking on his journalism career. The political arena and the influence that goes along with it have always fascinated him. Running a newspaper felt like pressing his nose against the glass. As an elected official, Hearst would finally have his hands directly on the levers of power. And with his family fortune, he can plow millions into a campaign. Hearst runs as a progressive Democrat, following in the footsteps of his father, a lifelong liberal. Hearst may have grown up with a silver spoon, but he takes up for the working man, despite his efforts to suppress the newsboy strike years earlier. His base is the city's swelling immigrant population.
The kinds of people who move their lips when they read.
That's what he likes to say behind closed doors. But he welcomes their votes, and soon he's got the powerful Tammany Hall political machine in New York lined up behind him, too. It's November 5th, 1902, election night. At the Hoffman House in New York, the city's most lavish hotel, a crowd of Hearst supporters are gathered in an upstairs ballroom. Streamers and balloons hang from the chandeliers, and a 30-foot-tall photograph of Hearst towers over the room from one wall. For Hearst, the hotel is a good luck charm, the place where he drew up plans for his first editions of the New York Journal years earlier. There's a buzz in the air as the early returns come in. A rumor ripples through the room that Hearst's opponent has just called to concede. Hearst's campaign manager takes the stage to address the expectant crowd.
Ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome to the stage the congressman-elect from the state of New York, Mr. William Randolph Hearst.
Thank you. Thank you all so much. I am proud to be serving the people in a new way, and to the many loyal readers of Hearst publications, do not fear, the company will continue to prosper during my time in Washington. I can assure you of that. With technology as it is today, I will only be a telephone call away.
Hearst soon finds that championing the cause of labor is not that easy. Day-to-day governing is a decidedly unglamorous affair. In Washington, far from the social whirl of New York, Hearst is restless. He sets a record for absenteeism, missing 168 of 170 roll calls during his first term. Still, after two terms in Congress, Hearst can't resist aiming for higher office. In 1904, he drops $2 million on a run for the Democratic presidential nomination. But his campaign strategy is unfocused. Voters, perhaps sensing that he's more opportunist than true believer, fail to support him. Hearst runs for both mayor and governor of New York in the years that follow, but he comes up short in both races. By the end of the decade, his political career is over. Humbled, Hearst returns to his old job at the paper. In some ways, going back to the Journal feels like an embarrassing retreat. But Hearst is still only 47 years old. He has plenty of chapters left. While Hearst dabbled in politics, Joseph Pulitzer has stayed close to the news business, the business he knows and loves. And in 1909, that focus pays off with his biggest scoop ever. His investigative team at the World stumbles on a fraudulent payment of $40 million by the United States to the French Panama Canal Company. The canal, which will open 5 years later and revolutionize global shipping, has for years been a massively corrupt enterprise. And Pulitzer's team has caught the U.S. government red-handed. After a series of damning articles, government officials in Washington hold an emergency closed-door meeting.
We have to do something about Pulitzer. This is criminal. They do have the right to publish.
They don't have a right to libel. Pulitzer's wronged this office. President Roosevelt, J.P. Morgan, I could go on. That man has to pay.
I just wonder if a lawsuit would stick.
If you want your job to stick, you'll get that indictment drafted.
Understood, sir.
Got it. I'll go see the Attorney General at once.
Pulitzer is on his yacht, the Liberty, when word of the indictment reaches him. He's sitting in the main berth with his wife, Catherine, his closest confidant, and the person who has shared most of this 30-year newspaper journey with him. He values her opinion more than any other.
Catherine, Teddy Roosevelt is trying to destroy my paper.
He can't do that, not over you exercising your rights. It's not libel if it's true.
Well, I'm glad you agree. I'll tell them to make sure to call you as a character witness.
Pulitzer braces against a chair for support. The battle with the government proves short-lived. The indictments are dismissed by the federal court, which finds that the world was doing nothing more than exercising its constitutionally protected freedom of the press. For Pulitzer, the verdict is the ultimate validation. The victory makes him temporarily forget his constellation of physical ailments, which now include near total blindness. But he can't keep ahead of his body forever. One evening in 1911, he's on board his yacht off the coast of South Carolina. Pulitzer's German secretary is reading aloud to him from an account of the reign of Francis Louis XI. Louis XI has always been a favorite of Pulitzer. His name was Louis the Prudent. Louis lived out most of his years in solitude, and Pulitzer always saw great nobility in that. The secretary nears the end of the chapter, reading a sequence describing the death of the French king.
The lights begin to dim. The world felt like it was falling away.
Pulitzer murmurs a reply in German.
Softly, quite softly.
These words would be his last. At the age of 64, Joseph Pulitzer, media titan, journalist to the end, slips away.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
The death of his old rival doesn't quite stop Hearst in his tracks, but the mogul does take time to pay his respects. In an editorial appreciation, Hearst calls Pulitzer the originator of the journalism of action and achievement, and a Democrat in doctrine and in deed. Hearst has never suffered the ill health Pulitzer did. At 48, he's as strong as an ox, with time still left to shape his legacy. But that legacy is in jeopardy. Hearst returns to the Journal to find that his decade in politics has weakened the paper he still owns. Radio is starting to take over newspapers as a mass medium. The Journal has been forced to shrink its once unbeatable staff. Now, it's getting outflanked by crosstown upstarts it helped spawn. like the New York Daily News. In 1919, it debuts as the first New York City paper printed in a vertical tabloid format to make page turning easier on the subway. The pugnacious paper makes its reputation by sneaking a camera into the execution of murderess Ruth Snyder. The paper prints a picture snapped the moment the switch is thrown on the electric chair. Sensing the ground shifting underfoot, Hearst makes a bid to buy out the Daily News. The paper rebuffs him, so in 1924, he launches a rival, the Daily Mirror. The Mirror has its moments. In a flashback to the heady days of the journal, it lures big names away from competitors and hires the best talent Hearst's money can buy. Though it eventually becomes the top circulated paper in the country, its revenue has to float other money-losing Hearst papers. And it never gains anywhere near the cultural influence the journal once had. This second taste of disappointment makes Hearst restless again. He begins to produce movies, getting to know the film business one starlet at a time. As he approaches middle age, he also revels in one of his inheritances, 40,000 acres on a hill overlooking the Pacific Ocean in San Simeon, California. Back before he launched the Mirror, the native Californian started to wonder if putting down roots in his home state might make him feel more centered, more in control of his destiny. He commissioned builders to set to work on a new vision, Hearst Castle. Construction of his estate and the surrounding grounds will go on for nearly three decades. The castle is a seductive monument to American success and excess. It has two Olympic-sized pools, an indoor compound totaling 90,000 square feet, and a host of antiques Hearst has flown in from Europe. By the 1930s, while the rest of America soldiers through the Depression, Hearst Castle, which he puckishly calls the Ranch, sees some of Hollywood's starriest gatherings. Some of the Hearst Corporation's flagship papers have started bleeding red, but price is no object for Hearst. Imported champagne by the truckload, the finest cigars from Cuba, artwork specially commissioned to fill the seemingly endless walls. Charlie Chaplin once spends an hour by the pool before realizing he's at the wrong party. Hearst is throwing two separate galas on different ends of the property. One keen observer of this social whirl and Hearst's epic life story is a young actor and director by the name of Orson Welles. Barely 20, Welles is a self-possessed hard charger cut from similar cloth as Hearst himself. One sun-splashed morning in May 1940, Hearst is in an upstairs bedroom at the castle. A butler brings a tray with coffee, toast, and the day's newspapers, as well as a copy of the Daily Variety. He sets it down on the side table.
Good morning, Elkins.
Good morning, sir.
Hearst grabs the Variety and looks closer at the cover.
What's this?
I do believe it's your life, sir.
No, no, no. This will not work.
I actually think it could work, sir. Your life is pretty cinematic, I'd say. Though I've not heard of this young director, Orson Welles.
No, no. I mean, this will not work. It will never see the light of day. Not if I have anything to say about it.
Welles bases his 1941 film, Citizen Kane, extensively on Hearst's life. Let's just say that the print media mogul doesn't take Welles' portrayal lying down. In fact, he's outraged by the insult to his legacy and the depiction of his longtime mistress, Marion Davies, as a melancholy drunk. His battle to stop the film is epic. Without ads and publicity in Hearst papers, the film will struggle to get attention. One of Hearst's most important foot soldiers in Hollywood is gossip columnist Luella Parsons. After RKO invites her arch-rival Hedda Hopper to a screening of Citizen Kane first, she's only too happy to help her boss get even. Hell hath no fury like a columnist scorned. It's the spring of 1941. Parsons decides to pay a visit to George Schaefer, the head of RKO Pictures.
George, you must be so proud of this new picture, Citizen Kane.
We are. We've gotten nothing but raves in the previews. Well, it's going to need to be quite a masterpiece if it's going to survive. Excuse me, survive? That film will not enjoy one iota of support from Hearst newspapers. No ads will be taken, no review will be run. And I've got months to write columns about Mr. Wells, about RKO, about all sorts of things. Why would you do that, Luella? Are you still steamed about the screening? There's a simple way you could avoid all of this hullabaloo. Just kill the picture. What? If you agree to put it in a vault, you can cash it in on the rest of your business. Just imagine that kind of wind at your back.
There's a pause. Schaefer is stunned.
Why don't you think it over and call me by tomorrow, before deadline, or the drumbeat begins?
RKO doesn't shelve the film, and so Hearst tries another ugly tactic, one that could shut down every studio in town. He threatens to print that many of the studios and agencies are run by Jews. The studio chiefs are terrified that anti-Semitism could kill off the young medium before it gets off the ground. Louis B. Mayer, the Jewish co-founder of MGM, personally offers to write RKO a check for more than $800,000 in exchange for the negative of Citizen Kane. He promises to burn it. RKO perseveres, and eventually the film does get a small release. But Hearst's boycott hurts. Wells' masterpiece comes and goes in theaters, losing money. Nominated for 9 Oscars, it comes home with just 1. Hearst is now in his 70s, with a pronounced paunch and dark circles under his eyes. The brawl over Citizen Kane has revealed a nasty, hostile side that for years was tempered by his polite, high-society upbringing. During these World War II years, he shows alarming sympathies for European fascists. Almost unimaginably, Hearst-owned papers run op-ed columns written by Hitler's propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels. Hearst's extravagance eventually catches up with him, too. Movies he produced for his mistress, Marion Davies, have flopped badly, and Hearst discovers he is tens of millions of dollars in debt. He has to sell off the trappings of his success one by one: tapestries, paintings, furniture, and jewelry. Hearst Castle is stripped nearly bare. Hearst continues to write a weekly column syndicated in Hearst papers. In one, he takes stock of his early days going head-to-head with his old rival.
Life was not one damn thing after another then. It was one wonderful adventure after another. The competition of journalism was a glad sport, and yet back of it all was a due sense of responsibility, a genuine desire to use the powers and opportunities of the press to serve and to save.
In Orson Welles' film, Charles Foster Kane, his stand-in for Hearst, at one point sums it up to his legal guardian.
You know, Mr. Bernstein, if I hadn't been very rich, I might have been a really great man.
Don't you think you are?
I think I did pretty well under the circumstances.
Meanwhile, Pulitzer will in time become revered as the patron saint of journalism. When Pulitzer faced down the government over the Panama Canal story, it led him to consider again the important role the press plays in society. He hadn't always stayed true to his ideals as a businessman, but in the twilight of his life, they remained at his core. As he wrestled with his legacy, he was eager to affirm them. A few years before he died, he talked to his wife, Catherine, about it.
Do you remember this letter I wrote a couple of years back?
You mean the one to the dean at Columbia?
Yes. Our republic and its press will rise or fall together. An able, disinterested, public-spirited press with trained intelligence to know the right and the courage to do it can preserve that public virtue, without which popular government is a sham, and a mockery.
The government can be that even without that public virtue.
A cynical, mercenary, demagogic press will produce in time a people as base as itself. The power to mold the future of the Republic will be in the hands of the journalists of future generations.
I hope they're up to the task.
Today, the newspapers he started haven't lived on. But Pulitzer's $2 million gift to Columbia University helped fund its journalism school, and every year that school gives out the prizes that still bear his name, prizes for the finest reporting the profession has to offer, the Pulitzer Prize. The name Pulitzer is synonymous with the very best in journalism. In death, Pulitzer finally achieved the legacy he had always hoped for.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I hope you enjoyed this final episode of the battle between Hearst and Pulitzer. Our next business war will focus on Ford versus Chevrolet. But first, we'll conclude our series on Hearst and Pulitzer with an interview with USC journalism professor Gabriel Kahn. I'm your host, David Brown. Dade Hayes wrote our story. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Edited and produced by Jenny Lauer. Sound designed by Bay Area Sound. Our executive producer is Marshall Louie. And our program was created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Yo, Trey.
Yeah, Kevin, what's up, man?
I was just thinking, what would have happened if Drew Brees didn't fail his physical with the Dolphins and ended up playing under Nick Saban in Miami?
There's a good shot the Finns establish a dynasty. Tom Brady and Bill Belichick probably don't become GOATs, and Tuscaloosa doesn't become the center of the college football universe.
That's a butterfly effect for real.
Hey, I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass
or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.